Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Panier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. On April 30th, Uzbekistan will hold a national referendum to approve a new constitution. Amendments prepared by a government-appointed committee affect some 65% of the current constitution, but the change that's attracted the most attention is the extension of the presidential term from 5 to 7 years. The controversy over this term extension has overshadowed other changes that, on paper, seem to represent positive steps in reforming Uzbekistan's legislation. It's not the only controversy connected to this referendum. The violence in Uzbekistan's Western Karakalpakstan Republic on July 1st and 2nd, 2022 will also always be linked with this upcoming referendum and new constitution. To discuss all this and more, I am joined by Nabahar Imamova, a veteran correspondent for the Uzbek service at Voice of America and host of America Avazi program, Alisher Ilhamov, director of Central Asia Due Diligence, who has written many articles about Uzbekistan, including some articles about the trials of protesters in Karakalpakstan. All are posted on CentralAsiaDueDiligence.uk, and that's CentralAsiaDueDiligence, one word, .uk. And Steve Sverdlov, a rights lawyer who has spent many years focusing on Central Asia and is currently an associate professor of the practice of human rights at the University of Southern California. Thank you all for joining me. Nabahar, I'd like to start with you if I could, because I'm curious about Uzbekistan's people and how they view this new constitution. The government commission that drafted it said they were working on the principle of society is the initiator of reforms. In the days leading up to the referendum, the message at public events staged by the state is my constitution, your constitution, our constitution. What do people in Uzbekistan you speak with say about the upcoming referendum and new constitution?
Hello, Bruce. Thanks for having me in the show. It's always great to be on this podcast. You know, as much as the Uzbek officials disagree, as much as the Uzbek lawmakers disagree with this assessment, the current campaign in Uzbekistan mostly reminds the Karimov period propaganda, which is a clear backsliding. Last two elections in Uzbekistan that I covered up close, specifically the parliamentary election in 2019 and even the presidential election in 2021, did have some nuances. And while we didn't see any opposition in the picture, it did provide some space for criticism in the media, in public events, featuring live discussions, live broadcasts, debates, heated exchanges, and the media and citizens in general seemed quite energized in 2018 elections, for example. Reporters and producers seemed more confident and relatively freer in their work. The presidential election campaign in 2021, just to compare with, started with a similar spirit, but it eventually turned into a tightly controlled operation. This time around, the control is sturdier. It's been so far, the Uzbek media have been instructed to provide as much positive programming as possible, showcase that people want change, that the society is eager to have a new basic law, the Uzbek show business, art and culture community, education sector, businesses even have been urged to promote the referendum, which means they must sing the praises of the policies in place, emphasize that the reforms are bearing fruits, and that Uzbekistan is on the right path, the path of democracy, that is, and through various events, demonstrate gratitude for the changes Uzbekistan has seen under President Mirziyoyev, project trust in him, show support of him. So this referendum campaign has been featuring, you know, open-air concerts, singing and dancing, and basically expression of optimism through performances by popular singers, poets and writers, motivational speeches by business leaders, and it even has involved foreign-based Uzbeks, including here in the United States. There was a delegation in Washington earlier this month from Tashkent. President Mirziyoyev's foreign policy advisor, Abdulaziz Kamilov, was here, Senate's first chair, Sadiq Safayev, and head of the Development Strategy Center in Tashkent, Eldar Tulyakov. They all told the Biden administration and others here that it is the people of Uzbekistan, as you just mentioned, who want change, who want to change the Constitution, and that more than 2,000 proposals poured in from across the country, and that the referendum is the will of the people. But if we examine the background, we see how this evolved. We know that President Mirziyoyev wanted this for a while now. He's been pushing to amend the Constitution for years. His inauguration speech in 2021, following his re-election, made that very clear. But then last spring, the newly formed the Constitutional Commission came out with a narrative that argued that this was what the Uzbek people wanted. It caused much debate then on social media. It's still, that debate is still on Uzbek social media. But the establishment kept on repeating it so much that it backfired in Qoraqalpakistan. We know that. Thousands came out protesting, denying that the system, denying what the system was insisting. Basically saying, no, this is not what we want. Why are you doing this without consulting with us, without discussing with us, and more importantly, without informing us? So following those events in Nukus, which cost 21 lives, we have to keep in mind, the Mirziyoyev administration seemed to reanalyze the whole strategy a bit. It postponed the referendum. But President Mirziyoyev is determined to get this done, as we see, you know, as soon as possible. So based on everything I've been hearing and watching, Bruce, I am predicting humbly that the citizens of Uzbekistan will be asked to cast another vote by the end of the year. I think the Mirziyoyev administration is working on it. I will be really, really surprised if Uzbekistan won't hold a presidential election within a few months after this referendum, to seal, to ensure a new term for Mirziyoyev under this new constitution, thus clearing the way for him to run again in 7 years. So, you know, I asked the Uzbek delegation visiting recently about how the Uzbek parliament was going to nullify Mirziyoyev's two terms so far with this new constitution. Simple question, right? They said that this issue was not even on the agenda. And that's not true at all. This has been on the agenda. And the vision, you know, this has been the vision from the very beginning. And if you listen to the public, especially on social media, you hear that, you know, that public opinion echoes this prediction, this kind of a mood in Uzbekistan right now.
Well, thank you, Nalbahar. Appreciate that, especially the thought of a snap election before the end of the year. That's interesting. Alisher, I want to ask you kind of in the same vein. I mean, you've been watching, you know, these elections and referenda in Uzbekistan for you know, decades now. Also, you know, strangely, the last referendum, national referendum they held was in 2002, and it also approved extending the presidential term from 5 to 7 years. Obviously, it was later reduced back to 5 years again. But is there anything new about the way the government's going about changing the constitution and holding this referendum? Anything new at all compared to previous events, similar events?
The new is that, first of all, they kind of now adopting not just amendments, going to vote for some selected number of amendments, but it's presenting as a new constitution, first one. Last year, they were just planning to make a number of amendments, let it be kind of a big number of them, but still specific amendments. Now we're talking about a new constitution from formal point of view, formal legal point of view. Second is... of course, the nullifying Mirziyoyev's current presidential terms, it was the main kind of central point, main motivation behind kind of initiating these amendments and the new constitutions. But the way how they're going to nullify, it's a little bit not distinct from the past. What happened now, the constitution itself doesn't say anything about nullification. It says that actually all the key positions in the government, including the president, has a kind of limits for being to be elected by two terms only, two consecutive terms. But it was not clear how would it apply to the already ongoing second term of Mirziyoyev for the moment. And only Constitutional Court made a point several days ago. They stated that this constitution, this position, especially the provision of limiting by two terms for presidential term, would apply and would they would not consider previous kind of the his kind of the background and his kind of the fact that he is holding two terms, right? And it kind of they would kind of pretend as he would not start from the kind of from the zero point. Do you understand? This was just the statement. The clarification was made several days ago by Constitutional Court. I was expecting initially that after the adoption of this constitution, only later they will decide that we have a new reality and therefore Medvedev has a right to go for the second for another kind of term because we have a new country, a new kind of law. Now they already made such specification, kind of such clarification that this kind of the nullification would apply immediately, despite the fact that the old constitution, the current constitution, limits his kind of terms by two, and the new one also limits by two. But the what is between them? So they kind of making point that the previous terms of it will not be counted. But I have made another kind of very important findings. I just made analysis well before this kind of majlis, this podcast. What I have found is actually this, there are some indications that, in fact, despite all these claims and the statements that these constitutions allow for going further with along reforms, in fact, the new provisions are in, kind of made in this on the key positions, on the key points. I would just clarify some later. Only make this current system governments moving toward the monarchy. Do you understand? It's towards more autocracy. Why? Because the for instance, the key positions in the government, you know, like for the prime minister or the prosecutor general, their candidates would be presented to the parliament, and the parliament would not kind of approve these candidates, but will just endorse. They use the if it's a kind of the use the Russian language. Instead of утвердить, they're using одобрить. In the Uzbek, it's instead of таскитлаш, they use макулаш, instead of таскитлаш. That means the parliament is going to be consulted only on these positions, and they would be expected just to endorse, not to approve. That means, in fact, actually, or de facto, the euro, the parliament itself turning from the kind of body which has a kind of certain powers, at least formal powers, to approve certain key positions in the government system, now turning into the just consulting body. And the kind of final decision to approve the prime minister, the ministers, prosecutor general, not to say about the chairperson of the National Security Service, the State Security Service, which is even not to be kind of endorsed, expected not to be endorsed, but just consulted. That means all these powers are going to the president. This is a conclusion that one can make upon this kind of the language used by this new constitution. This is my main findings I have done.
No, this is very interesting. You know, in fact, so because you know, Kazakhstan went through the same thing last year in approving a new constitution, right? But part of that was supposed to be that more power would be or powers would be transferred from the executive branch to the legislative branch. But your research seems to indicate that it's the opposite in Uzbekistan, that actually the executive power is gaining more out of this at the expense
of... Yeah. So he kind of acquiring on the top of his executive powers, he acquiring more legislative powers, to endorse, in fact, the key positions in the government system, such as I said, prime minister, the members of cabinet of ministers, and the prosecutor general. This is three key kind of main kind of positions going to be finally approved if to read properly the language, because they amended, they substitute the word approval by the word endorsement. Endorsement is not approval. It's something has been missed by the kind of the public, by the experts. I would just ask to comment how you understand this kind of the amendments in the language of this constitution. My understanding is it's just indication that of transferring more powers from the parliament, even formal, let it be kind of just formal powers. Let it be, this parliament to be kind of the pocket parliament. But even the, my understanding, the president doesn't trust even such a parliament, such a kind of a pocket parliament, maybe expecting in the future kind of the intensifying the powers, I mean, the struggle for power and depriving the parliament, even of those formal powers which he has got on kind of appointing the key positions in the government system.
Huh. Okay. Thank you, Alisher. These are interesting points.
Navbahor, maybe Navbahor with a comment, how she understands this words, taskitlash and makulash.
Well, I haven't heard any analysis of this, and this is a very cute observation by you, obviously, Alisher. I don't think many Uzbek lawmakers who have approved this draft have thought of that. At least I haven't heard of any conversations or any debates on this. But there is a difference between the word tasqlash and maqulash, as you say. And I agree with your interpretation of this. So this would be really something interesting to watch, the semantic differences, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. Steve, do you want to say something? Because I certainly have a lot of questions for you coming here.
Yeah, no, and I know we're going to get more into the weeds of how the different amendments, actually what they do legally contribute or change or add or subtract from Uzbekistan's very at-risk democratic project. But I'll just start by saying that I read a quote of an analyst that this line started like this, an article that said, "Few doubt that the prolongation of the presidential term in Uzbekistan's referendum paves the way for presidency for life." And that was actually the first line of an article that Alisher Elhamov on this very podcast wrote about the constitutional referendum that extended Islam Karimov's term 20 years ago. And for me, you know, when I read those words, Alisher, I just thought to myself that not only is this deja vu, but, you know, for those of us that root for reforms, that care about human rights, progress, and democracy, and follow it as closely. And there are no two people who are more expert on these issues than Nabor and Alisher. This is really a death knell for the reform project. It's extremely consequential, and it doesn't have to be, can't be overstated just how fundamental this April 30th event will be for, in a way, closing a chapter. If indeed, unless we see the president step up and or the Constitutional Court or other voices, prominent voices, explicitly limit his term and explicitly clarify or submit an amendment that clarifies that indeed his terms will be limited and that there will be no nullification, no zeroing out, then really we've entered a new phase, a phase in which Mirziyoyev's term is enshrined essentially for life. And it really undermines everything that I think the government has stated about its ambitious reform agenda for years, as much as the crackdown on bloggers and other areas of human rights have faltered. I think this is very fundamental and really deserves a lot of attention from all the international actors, such as the Human Rights High Commissioner, who was just there, also the EU Human Rights Commissioner, who was just there. I know they were raising these issues, but unfortunately, the government and the president himself are not reassuring these partners or the people that there will not be this for life presidency. And so I'm looking very closely at that, but I'm just struck again, first and foremost, we have to start with that deja vu that the man that came in saying that everyone was exhausted by the stagnation and the depression of the Karimov period is now reenacting those same tactics and techniques. That, I think, is a major, major disappointment. I think we should begin with that. And everything that flows from that, yes, there are many innovations that deserve close analysis. But I'm just going to start with the call to the government, or to the president in particular, to give a press conference in which he clarifies that this is not going to result in nullification. Of course, I think, you know, Nabuhr reads the situation better than anyone and has really tried to probe for those sorts of analyses, and they're not forthcoming. But I think amidst the otherwise deteriorating human rights record, the forced evictions that we've seen, you know, I think Alisher's point is extremely interesting about the parliament. Again, it's been a stated goal of the government. And even we should say, even during Karimov's late period, where he tried to talk about the importance of the Oli Majlis before his death. You know, we did have the most independent MP resign under pressure, Rasul Kusherbayev, in December. So we've been watching this encroaching executive power in a way. In some ways, you know, the old habits really do die hard. And the stage managed aspects of this campaign with the dancers and singers is all too much deja vu. But I do want to say, I think this new period in Uzbekistan, also even this referendum, I want to, you know, end my first comment on a more hopeful note, which is that I think it was you, Nabuhor, that circulated a satirical video from Jahangir Ahmedov. And this was it seems like it's going viral right now. It's a video of a teacher in a school, and the principal is coming in, and, you know, they're saying no forced labor. No one's going to the cotton fields, but you have to vote. And it's a brilliant satire of what Uzbekistan's democracy currently looks like, which is that there's a lot of rhetoric about choice and about dialogue between the government and the people, which has been the main theme of this government for the last 6 years. And yet, that underlying pressure, the pressure on bloggers, the pressure on journalists, the unwritten lines, the unseen, the unspoken limits on freedom of expression are more than ever being felt. And I think that is something that we all have to pay attention to. So that'll just begin there, Bruce, if that's too general.
No, I mean, that's great. You know, and let's start this. We're getting close to the halfway point, but I want to get into some of the other changes in the Constitution too, which you are, you know, absolutely the most qualified person I can think of to comment on, is some of these changes in the law that's happening. You know, there's obviously, this document is much longer than the old document. There's many more articles in this one. They elaborate points in the previous Constitution to kind of tease out thoughts and stuff. So it's there's a lot of things included in the draft, this draft constitution, that weren't there or weren't as well explained in the constitution that they're currently using. And one I'm thinking of is the habeas corpus, for instance.
Yes.
Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, I was struck by this, and I think, you know, you, Bruce and I, we spoke about this offline, that there are some things that reflect some of them reform moves, or what the government considers its most important achievements in the area of human rights over the past several years. And you can almost hear the voice of the human rights minister. You know, some call him a chief propagandist, but he certainly considers himself the expert on human rights issues. That's Akmal Saidov. You can almost hear his voice in this draft, because in the new articles, looking at the draft of the Constitution, we see articles 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, are codifying things that you might normally only see in a criminal code or a criminal procedure code, which, interestingly to me, the reason this constitution is now so long is that it seems that the government really wants to double down and emphasize its achievements, its progress in certain criminal justice areas in particular, like habeas corpus. And if we remember, after Andijan, the government had very little to show for itself in the way of human rights progress of any kind. It was an extremely dark period after the Andijan massacre. And 3 years later, amidst sanctions that were only slowly coming off of Uzbekistan, amidst a deep isolation, Karimov implemented the habeas corpus, which is the right, you know, from the Latin term, it's the right to know the charges against you, to be brought before a judge, to explain the legality of your detention. And the reason that's so important is because we know that torture often happens right after a person's detained in the first 2 or 3 days. And it used to be in Uzbekistan that you could be detained for 72 hours. But now it's been codified here and earlier in the criminal code that, in line with international law, you can only be detained up to 48 hours, which is the international standard. So that's found its way into this draft, which I found interesting because it seems to say that the government wants the world to know that there are certain norms of criminal justice that I think it feels it's been criticized over for many years, but it deserves, in a way, recognition for accepting these norms and actually placing them directly into the Constitution. Same, I should say, goes for the death penalty, which is, in a way, an even more prominent achievement. And I want to recognize here that there would be no moratorium on the death penalty. There would be no abolition of the death penalty without the heroic, and I'm sure Ali Sharon Nabuhor remember her name, Tamara Chikunova was a human rights defender who's no longer with us, but her son was on death row, and she campaigned about the need to reject and ban the death penalty. And so that's also in this constitution. I think it's interesting that those two achievements are really trumpeted up front.
Good. And we're going to come right back to that in a second, because I want to get into this a little bit more about some of these other changes in the Constitution. But we have reached a halfway point in our discussion. So it is time for me to remind that this is the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I am Bruce Panier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. And we're talking about the upcoming constitutional referendum in Uzbekistan and what changes with this constitution. And joining me to discuss this are Alisher Ohamov, director of Central Asia Due Diligence, who has written many articles about Uzbekistan, some of which you can find on the website CentralAsiaDueDiligence.uk, and CentralAsiaDueDiligence is one word, UK. Steve Sverdlow, a rights lawyer who spent many years focusing on Central Asia and is currently an associate professor of practice of human rights at the University of Southern California. And Nabahar Imamova, veteran correspondent for the Uzbek service at Voice of America and the host of the weekly program, America Abazi. Is that right, Nabahar?
Yes, correct.
Okay, good. I just wanted to clarify it was the weekly show. Steve, I'm going to come back to you right away for a second, and then I want everyone to come in on this. There's a lot of changes. I mean, we mentioned habeas corpus, but there's changes in the rights for women. I mean, they seem to have taken a little bit from some of these recommendations that they've supposedly been getting from the public. You know, that you can't discriminate against women who have children. That can't be the reason for not hiring them or for dismissing them because they have children at home that they need to take care of or are pregnant. There's articles that seem to address a little bit obliquely home demolitions in Uzbekistan, in the rights of children with special educational needs to receive inclusive education, things like that. So, I mean, there are some nuggets that seem to be positive in this constitution. Is that, would you say?
I would. And I mean, the proof is going to be, as always, in the implementation. On forced evictions, we should say, you know, we've just had very recently, I think it was just a month ago in March, finally, after a five-year odyssey, one of the residents of Tashkent, Olga Abdullayeva, who was fighting in the courts to prevent her forced eviction, was finally pushed out of her home. And in that case, it seems to be very clear that someone very close to the president's family is behind that eviction. And so, you know, again, we have this contradiction. We have this constitution which enshrines some important human rights norms and does, as the rhetoric has centered, you know, centering the person. This is about the interest. This is a societal state. The interests of the person are paramount. That's actually in Article 20. We even had, you know, Bruce, as you and I discussed, the role of international law is reaffirmed as being of importance to the country, which I found extremely interesting, given that it goes against what Kyrgyzstan did a few years ago in response to international human rights criticism, which was reduce and minimize the importance of international law in that constitution. What Uzbekistan has done is said, no, we adhere to international law. International law is on par with our domestic law. And I mean, of course, in theory, this provides a whole new generation of human rights defenders and journalists and activists and analysts with a lot of fodder to advance the reforms in Uzbekistan. And yet we see, as Alisher, I think Nabahar have shown in their comments, that the reality of the way this is happening and the way the courts are behaving increasingly is to really turn back a page. But I think it was important, Bruce, I'll just won't go on too long, but you mentioned education and, of course, and gender. The one bright spot, undoubtedly, without any question, over the past year or more, is the new law criminalizing domestic violence, which, again, we have to give credit to the activists you had on your show, I think last week or the week before, who have been amazing, but also inclusive education. And I think it is true that there is a development, there is an evolution towards certainly putting the Soviet legacy of internati and terrible institutionalized approaches to persons with disabilities, putting that behind the country, or at least trying to turn a page. Also on rehabilitation in Article 55 and the ability to get recourse and go to an international court. I mean, these are really quite interesting. I'd be curious to hear what Nabahar and Alisher have to say about those specific provisions.
Now, this is what I want to get into. I'm going to ask Nabahar, we'll start with you, but Alisher, I'm going to let you go after Nabahar. You know, is this kind of like a you know, to balance the whole thing, I mean, a lot of people are suspicious that obviously the Constitution is all about keeping Mirziyoyev in power. So are they giving these little bits, in your opinion, you know, improvements in legislation? Is that kind of in some way make it more acceptable to the public to extend Mirziyoyev's term because they're actually getting some more better, what at least on paper, they seem to have more rights. And there's a whole different section of, you know, various groups that are getting these rights too. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Bruce, we have to keep several, at least a couple of important factors here in mind. Overall, you don't see or you don't sense an opposition to these changes, to these amendments among the public. I haven't heard of any, denunciations or any kind of, harsh criticism of any part of it. Mostly people are debating the presidential term because they can see what's coming. They can smell, what's coming next. But otherwise, people are happy to read this draft. It's been available in Uzbek, Russian, and English for a while now. And if you turn on TV, in Uzbekistan, the Uzbek media, state, independent, private, all of them are discussing these, changes. And the main argument they constantly hear is that this one reflects where Uzbekistan is and should be and must go to, based on these changes. The government is arguing that these reforms will establish Uzbekistan as a sovereign, democratic, legal, social, and secular state with a republican form of state. So those are the kinds of stressed points that Uzbek public has been listening to. And again, you don't really hear much, specific criticism other than the presidential term changing. And the second factor is that the government seems, at least based on my analysis, seems quite aware of the cynicism within the public towards these changes. They hear the people out and loudly saying, well, so far the government, the leadership hasn't really been good at following the Uzbek constitution, the existing constitution. So what makes us think that they will be now honoring the new one, right? So that's like a general sort of cynical points that you hear both on social media and just in day-to-day Uzbekistan now. And the government doesn't necessarily directly respond to that. They're just increasing that, what I described earlier, the cream of period-like propaganda, just stress, repeat, and repeat. So, yes, I mean, people do acknowledge that there are positive changes that are at least on paper, being guaranteed and ensured. I mean, Steve discussed the human rights. The government says it's been human rights related parts of the constitution have multiplied like 3.5 times. So, there is this quantitative analysis. And of course, we have to also mention that this new constitution will also guarantee where state will guarantee freedom of all religious organizations actively operating in Uzbekistan's laws, freedom of media activity covering their rights to seek, receive, use, and disseminate information. It's also, it talks about impeding or interfering with the activities of mass media in Uzbekistan is now being determined by a cause for legal liability. And then a constitutional norm is now introduced on the creation by the state of conditions for providing access to the internet. So the fact that these are specifically mentioned, argue lawmakers, these are pieces of progress for Uzbekistan. So I would generally argue that the positive changes are recognized. People admit that these changes are being, guaranteed, and they get it. But again, there is there isn't much credibility in the state itself to follow up to these, to these basic laws now that the many Uzbek officials call norms.
Can I come in real quick? I know Alisher was going to while it's on my mind, Bruce, as Navarro was speaking, I had a thought.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Just to say that, I mean, Nabor is absolutely right. It is really significant. For example, I didn't pay as close attention to the sort of the codification of journalists' right to seek and receive information. That's also fundamental to human rights. But as we sit here and talk about this, what is so striking And looking at this constitutional draft, also Article 142, it codifies lawyers' access to their clients, which was another huge issue that we've all followed for years, which is, you know, lawyers showing up to the security services building and then games being played with them to prevent them from seeing their clients during the interrogations. What's interesting about this is that while all these provisions look great, isn't it interesting that the civil society working groups that have tried to work closely over the past 5 years with the government to implement codes, individual criminal codes, the code on the legal profession, the code on NGOs, all of those efforts have sort of died in infancy or, died in darkness or in silence. And that would be the level on which civil society groups or the legal profession or a union of journalists could actually more concretely point to concrete rights. Whereas I think the danger here is that these provisions that exist only in the Constitution or at this highest level, they would, I guess, require litigation at the Constitutional Court or in a much more nebulous realm than what we're used to seeing in the day-to-day operations of society. And so, therefore, it's I'm very torn about this, but it's we have to recognize that all these processes, all these conversations that have found their way into the Constitution have stalled at the level of real, even legal regulations, let alone other concrete evidence in society. And I'll just say that.
Okay, thanks. Alisher, your thoughts on some of these other changes?
Yeah, actually, I think each authoritarian regime is trying to balance between two different extremes. On the one hand, to achieve and maintain certain level of or degree political legitimacy. I mean, kind of the consent of the population with his rule or some kind of the relationship with the international community. This is on the one hand. On the other hand, is kind of still ensuring kind of control over power without being kind of properly and democratically elected. So between two balancing business, between two different kind of extremes, kind of making the reality actually the how he's conducting his his system, how he's ruling his system. So now we see the shift toward, in the past, actually, for instance, as a rule, actually, if your kind of political legitimacy kind of declining, the more you're resorting to the harsh methods of controlling the power, kind of including the repressions, restrictions of freedoms, civil freedoms, freedom of expression, and so on. But now we see the a little bit different situation when the constitution indicates that there are going to be some shift towards presidential powers at the expense of the parliament. This creates certain interesting kind of paradoxical situation when in order to still maintain the political legitimacy and the kind of some relationship with the major Western democratic powers in the world, the regime would be forced to provide some more kind of the concessions in the field, for instance, of human rights. And we have seen already lately when some legislation was adopted on the rights of the women, of women. There are some other minor changes taking place in the legal system and even in reality. So my point is that actually we see that there are still kind of such a power of the Senate to elect the Constitutional Court, the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Judicial Council is still in formal power of Senate. And the question was this, especially the Supreme Judicial Council, if it's properly elected, clear, that would bring us towards more closely to the establishing rule of law, which is the kind of probably the key question for the moment. Even if actually the president, the Mirziyoyev, even go further towards autocracy, the autocratic rule. There are still opportunities to combine the situation with some improving in the field of improving things in the field of rule of law. You know, in the history, we have such precedent. For instance, in 19th century, when in Germany, that was still a kind of monarchic rule, but at the same time, they managed to establish a relatively kind of independent judiciary. And only democracy came only in the beginning of the 20th century. So why not to happen in something similar to in Uzbekistan? I have some doubts it would actually take place in reality, but I have still some kind of some opportunities. And the question whether the regime of Mirziyoyev would have some sufficient political powers to make real steps towards establishing rule of law, and for instance, to let the Supreme Judicial Council to be elected really democratically, with some kind of support from legal experts, lawyers, and also international community.
Okay, thanks. And actually, that helps me to do the transition to the last part of the program, because we are just about out of time. I'm curious about what this is going to do to Uzbekistan's reputation. Both Mirziyoyev, he's been talking about new Uzbekistan, and yet, as we've already heard on the program, so much of this is already old. But I mean, there have been a lot of people who have engaged with Uzbekistan since Karimov died because they thought that it was new Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan was changing. I mean, keeping in mind that he is scheduled to go to Germany the day after the referendum is held, and I heard today that he's also going to be making an official visit to the Czech Republic later this year, too. So it seems like the West is going along with the system. Does this change Uzbekistan's international reputation? And Alisher, I'll start with you.
You know, if you remember what happened with Karimov years ago when he was invited to Czech Republic, and then after the pressure from civil society, he was not admitted, so he was forced to cancel. So he found himself in such international isolation, which very much damaged his the international profile. In my understanding, one of the main motive behind some limited reforms undertaken by Mirziyoyev was to avoid such a fate, to get isolated internationally. And he managed to do so actually by making some improvements in terms of human rights, for instance, abolishing the forced labor and child labor in the cotton industry. In some other areas, or some limited number of improvements. So this would keep him from going too far towards kind of autocratic and repressive rule. There might be some kind of the option that he will still establish even kind of more autocratic rule, at the same time combined with some improvements in the field of rule of law, in the field of human rights, such a kind of bizarre combination of monarchic rule with some kind of rooms for human rights, for civil society, and for the independence of the judiciary.
Okay, Nabahar, what do you think? What does this do to Uzbekistan's image, the new constitution?
Bruce, you know, there is very little doubt that this draft will not be approved, right? This is going to get approved on April 30th, and the government is going to coin this as a new compact between the state and the people, and that it'll be this responsible system, and that President Mirziyoyev has a new mandate. And despite all these changes we've been discussing so far in terms of giving more power to the parliament, to local administrations, President Mirziyoyev will remain the super president of Uzbekistan. But internationally, Tashkent will promote this as a new constitution where the government is now entrusted with the tasks of ensuring openness and transparency, legality and efficiency of the work of the executive authorities, improving the quality and accessibility of public services, providing effective functioning of the social protection system, and supporting civil society. So that's where they'll be really, really stressing internationally. And I think the next stage is really important here. The next stage of this mission, I would argue, is that it will be to ensure that Mirziyoyev stays in power, of course, but it will be the kind of a push where the propaganda, again, by the establishment, will be that Mirziyoyev is the only person to head Uzbekistan during this complex period, and that no one but him should complete this reform process that he started in in 2017 and that changing the leadership would jeopardize that process and that there are ill-intended forces inside and outside of Uzbekistan who want the country to go back. You know, that argument will also include maintaining security and sovereignty of Uzbekistan requires Mirziyoyev's stay in power and that he is the man to guard the national interests and continue this multi-vector foreign policy he's been advocating and that Uzbekistan will keep its doors open and continue engaging with everyone, the West, East, and everyone in between because of Mirziyoyev's vision. And that, of course, you know, that reminds the narratives that we have heard before in Uzbekistan during the Karimov presidency. But I think the international community here cannot be and should not be, obviously, oblivious to the fact that right now, we sense this deep disappointment in Uzbekistan, whoever I talk with, including those who actually, you know, support Mirziyoyev and credit him for the changes that they have seen under him. They say that they expected a different kind of approach. They expected the government to, Mirziyoyev's leadership to demonstrate openness and confidence by now, and that they basically want him to be the democratic leader that Uzbekistan has never seen, you know? They want him to leave power in 2016 when his current term is up and leave someone they understand behind who can offer more and lead Uzbekistan into a new period. Instead, now the disappointment is based that, you know, they're seeing the repeat of history and are concluding that Uzbekistan is never able or incapable at this point, despite Mirziyoyev's pledges and promises, and despite this new constitution, to get out of this authoritarian cycle. There is so much pessimism now that some intellectuals argue that the next leader of Uzbekistan, whenever that person emerges, will be the same. You know, promise of reforms, cosmetic changes, they say, and then back to more authoritarian tendencies, constitutional changes perhaps again, and then just, you know, hold on power through whatever tools available. That is the mood in Uzbekistan, and I think the international community feels it. I mean, at least the diplomats in Tashkent feel it and see it and hear it. And the government does, obviously, you know, as well. But the question is, what do you do with it, right?
Steve, then we get to you. And, you know, I was struck when Navahar was talking about this. He was mentioning very, very familiar things that, you know, we got to stick with the guy that we got. He's the one that can get us through these all these problems. And, you know, I mean, this could have come out of Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, something like that. And yet Mirziyoyev's image is much better internationally than the Tajik or Turkmen president's images are. Certainly the former Turkmen president, now head of the Halk Maslahati. But like I said, it's the same kind of thinking. And yet Mirziyoyev seems to be more acceptable somehow to the international community. What does this say about new Uzbekistan?
No, and I couldn't agree with Nabor's comments more just now. And, you know, I think let's start with the geopolitical context because you're asking about the international actors. I think one of the advantages that Uzbekistan has and is using, of course, two factors. One, of course, is going back to 2021 and the Taliban reconquering Afghanistan put Uzbekistan again in a position of being, you know, absolutely critical ally. That the United States and specifically the Pentagon really needed to rely on in a lot of ways, which really, I think, again, hems in the White House and the State Department in many ways in terms of what they're willing to raise on human rights issues, which has always been the tragedy. It's always been the what makes Uzbekistan such a tough case to advocate on is the border with Afghanistan and in a way the deal with the devil. Whether it's the Northern Distribution Network or it's now this context that we're currently in. The other factor, which Uzbekistan benefits from in some ways, although of course Uzbekistan, like every other country in the post-Soviet space, is pressured by Russia and by the war in Ukraine. But vis-a-vis the West, I think the United States, the European Union, as they are with other post-Soviet states, are reluctant to pressure Tashkent too hard on human rights, lest they, as they've always feared, push them into the embrace, push them over the line to Putin, or to China for that matter. And I think that also, unfortunately, that psychology that is really self-defeating on the part of the international actors, the West in particular, It's a sort of self-censoring of the calls for human rights, which I think ultimately does a disservice to our values supporting human rights. So I think those geopolitical factors, of course, are playing in a way to the advantage or relieving some of that pressure from the international community and giving Tashkent more room to maneuver. But again, it's a short-term gain, and it will be a disservice to everyone. But I think, you know, the internal context is really what matters most. I mean, yes, this absolutely, as Nabahor said, it's deja vu. It's a huge disappointment. And as we've seen just in the past week, let's look at those developments. We saw the prominent human rights lawyer of Uzbekistan, Sergei Mayorov, coming out and saying that his client, the leader of the Qarakalpak protest, Daulat Murad Tajimuratov, was tortured. Again, almost deja vu, right? Back to the Karimov period. And we saw a journalist, Shahida Yakub, being denied entry into Uzbekistan. So many things should be absolutely alarm bells that this is that Uzbekistan needs to be not only praised but pressured. Otherwise, I think we really could see a dangerous situation. Internally, though, what could ultimately really be decisive? It's not, unfortunately, because the international criticism is muted. It's gas shortages. It's another bad winter. It's corruption scandals. It's even the outrage that we saw over this child abuse and sex ring in Khwarezm. Those factors aren't going away. The government cannot silence civil society forever. It does have to be responsive to an incredibly dynamic, incredibly energetic, and talented and interesting populace, which is producing, as Nabahor would say, a lot of content, a lot of discussions. So that's not going away. I think it's absolutely right that as Mirziyoyev ages, as his reform agenda sort of wanes, this is a more dangerous period for an authoritarian regime. They have to understand that, I think, with this referendum, and with this, specifically the zeroing out of the term, they're really entering a phase which is a cliche, but also very much a minefield and presents a lot of dangers to autocrats. And so I would end again on a hopeful note that Mirziyoyev still has the power. He is the super president, as Nabahor says. And so he could, if he wanted to, come out and clarify that he will not do this. He will not become a lifetime president. And, you know, he could actually make good on those pledges. So let's hold him to that. Let's keep doing that. And that I can say as a human rights activist, I will do.
Okay, thank you. That's actually a really good way to end this conversation, because we are out of time, unfortunately. But thank you all very much. Big thanks to you, Steve, and to Nabahor and to Ali Shir for being on the program today. And, of course, thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C., And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asian Focus newsletter by visiting Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you very much, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.